Good afternoon. Welcome. My name is Dean Reuter. I'm the director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's program. And I'd like to give a special welcome to our C-SPAN audience today. Thank you for coming. Today's program is being sponsored by two of the Federalist Society's practice groups, the Labor and Employment Law Practice Group and the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. As you'll see as the program unfolds here before you today, the case that is the topic of today's program, Washington versus Washington Education Association, has implications for both the court's labor and free speech jurisprudence. Now, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank our panelists in advance for participating today. And I want to single out Eric Jaffe, our moderator today, for special thanks as I introduce him. Eric Jaffe is a 1990 graduate of Columbia Law School, after which he clerked for Judge, now Chief Judge, Douglas H. Ginsburg of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. After this clerkship, he entered private practice in the D.C. firm of Williams & Connolly. 5 years later, he clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, I think helping to begin the growing trend of hiring Supreme Court clerks with a little more legal experience than those just out of law school. He has blazed another trail, I think, as he's gone on to become a very rare bird, that is a solo practitioner with a lot of Supreme Court experience, a great Supreme Court practice, and an emphasis on the First Amendment. Importantly for our perspective here, he heads our free speech and election law practice group, which he's done for several years, very capably. So please join me in welcoming our moderator, Mr. Eric Jaffe.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I think what I'll do real quickly is give just the quick and dirty overview of the area for those of you who are not already familiar with it, and then just let the participants talk about the details of this case. As many of you may or may not know, there are lots of instances in which states authorize unions to represent, have unions that represent many of their employees, and those unions are also obliged to represent non-members of the unions. States therefore frequently authorize the unions to extract what is known as an agency fee, which helps defray the cost of such representation, collective bargaining, grievance adjustment, and the like. Those fees, those portions of the fees that go towards such collective bargaining activities are often a little bit less than full union dues, since the unions also do other things for their members. And there is often a dispute over what to do with the difference. Do the unions get to keep the full amount of the dues, even for non-members, or do they have to refund or deduct the non-germane fees, those fees that don't go to collective bargaining activities? In Washington State, what you have is a situation where the union can extract the full amount of the dues, but a non-member employee is allowed to request back that portion of the dues that does not go to collective bargaining activities. Washington then passed an initiative which put a further gloss on this, which said that in situations where those non-germane, non-collective bargaining funds are used for election-related speech, so that would be candidate elections or ballot propositions, the union has to get the affirmative consent of a member, not merely wait and see if the member decides to ask for a rebate. And it's that provision, that opt-in provision, that is the subject here. The Washington State Supreme Court held that that provision was unconstitutional in that it placed too much of a burden on the union's rights to hold on to this money, and that the employee's rights were fully protected by the ability to opt out, i.e. to ask for a rebate. And that is the way this case now comes up to the Supreme Court, with the Washington State Supreme Court having said the union has a right to use it unless the employee says no, and Washington State, via its statute, saying the employee has a right to at least some of that extra money unless they affirmatively choose to give it to the union. And that's where we're at. There seems to be First Amendment interest on both sides, which is why my practice group is interested in it. And without further ado, I believe I'll introduce the speakers each one as they go, but I'll turn initially to Attorney General McKenna.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. Also, I want to thank you for participating in the moot court on Monday. Several of the other moot court participants are here. Thank you very much for helping me prepare. It was very helpful to have that practice session. For Washington State, the interest is in upholding the statute approved by the voters, which provides this additional procedural requirement that a union must follow before they can use these compelled fees that Washington state law permits them to take from non-members for political purposes. They have to obtain the affirmative authorization. It is an additional requirement. It only applies to these 760, these what we call Section 760 expenses, these expenses to influence an election or to operate a political committee. And that makes it different than statute in Illinois, for example, which was at issue in the Hudson case, because in that case, the statute said that the union was not allowed to collect an agency fee that included any amount for expenses not related to collective bargaining, contract ratification, and grievances. But in Washington State, the voters passed a broad law, Initiative 134. It was our first campaign finance law that put contribution limits in place. It had 34 sections, and it included this provision, Section 760, which requires the affirmative authorization of the non-member fee payer before the union can use that money to influence an election or operate a political committee. It's that difference in the law, it is a law unique to Washington State thus far, which is the reason we're in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. That and the fact that the state Supreme Court sided with the Washington Education Association and ruled that the law was unconstitutional. Now, why did they do that? Well, the state Supreme Court found that there were First Amendment rights of the union implicated and burdened by this requirement to seek the affirmative authorization of the teachers. In other words, what the law says is you have to say yes, you have to get the teacher to say yes, or they have to volunteer to say yes prior to using their money for political purposes. The state Supreme Court said, well, the union has the money, they're allowed to collect it, so their speech is burdened. Now, the flaw in that and the key basis for our challenging their decision is that, in fact, in the state's view, the union does not have a First Amendment right to use this money because it's not their money. It's the teacher's money, the non-member teacher's money. It doesn't become the union's money to use for speech until the requirements of 760 are met, the requirement of affirmative authorization. And the state Supreme Court, unfortunately, found that, well, it's not really about the individuals at all. This is not a labor case. This is a campaign finance case, they said. And this is a case that should be analyzed. The burden imposed by the state, as they saw it, should be analyzed under strict scrutiny. Well, we simply don't believe that's the case. Possession of the fees does not entitle the WEA or any union to use the fees to influence elections without meeting the consent condition. The non-members own the fees until they've given their permission. And after all, we are talking about non-members here. These are people who have already said no once. They said, no, I don't want to join the union. The union's position is they have to be forced to say no expressly a second time so that their money isn't spent on political purposes. We think that should not be the default position, and the people of Washington evidently agreed in passing Initiative 134 by quite a wide margin. We don't think it's unreasonable to require them to say yes before the money can be used for political purposes. I think I'll just stop right there, Eric. I'm sure we're going to get into more of the issues, but I think those are the basic issues as we see it. The First Amendment interests of the fee payers versus the statutory right, not the constitutional right, but the right granted under statute to the unions to collect these fees to begin with, a right which, if the state can take it away altogether, which it can, it's only statutory, surely the state can condition with this affirmative authorization requirement.
Thank you very much. Next up, before we go to the next speaker, I just want to note Attorney General McKenna obviously represented the state in the Supreme Court just today, did an excellent oral argument, and hence is taking that position for the government, defending the statute that gives these employees more rights. On the other side, we had invited a number of union representatives to sort of take the union side, but for various and sundry reasons they were unable to make it. So instead, standing in for them, we have Professor Frederick Freiliker. He's a professor at George Washington University, where he teaches labor and employment law. He's also of counsel at Hunton and Williams. I would not want to necessarily attribute one side of this fight or the other to him, but I'm sure he is knowledgeable enough to take any and all sides that he chooses, as I'm sure he does with his students. In addition, I point out that he's an alumnus of Columbia University Law School, which I take great pleasure in, given that it's my alma mater, as well as he was a former general counsel to a member of the NLRB, and so obviously his background in this area is both deep and broad, and we appreciate your coming to help us explore both sides of this issue.
Thank you, Mary. The position of the Washington Education Association is that this particular provision unconstitutionally burdens the right of the Washington Education Association to engage in political speech, basically to support ballot propositions. I don't think they've done much or anything with political candidates, but they do something with the ballot propositions. And what the Washington Education Association is saying is that the statute was intended to protect the integrity of the election process and to protect the public so that there would be not be pressure brought on political candidates as a result of unreasonable or large political contributions, I suppose. The statute wasn't set up in general terms to protect the interests of non-union dues-paying members. And since the statute, this particular part of the statute, does impact adversely on the Washington Education Association's ability to collect dues, to use the dues that it collects from non-members by requiring them affirmatively to say that the dues can be used for political activities like ballot propositions, that it burdens their right of political speech. It affects the content of what they can do in terms of their political speech. And the result of that is that the court is required to apply a strict scrutiny of this particular statutory provision, which is what the Washington Supreme Court did in finding that the provision was unconstitutional, because there's no compelling governmental interest that's served by having non-members having to opt in as opposed to opting out. And the protection, whatever there might be, of the free speech rights of the non-union members who are paying dues, that protection is adequately presented by their right under the Supreme Court decisions to opt out if they care to do so. The Washington Education Association also points out that this statute has a particular direction towards impeding the political speech of unions, but does not affect corporations, for example, or other organizations. It's directed just at unions. There's an issue of whether that question was presented to the court below, but my own view is that you can offer in the Supreme Court alternate means for affirmance as a possibility for the court to consider. So that's the basic position.
Thank you. Our final speaker will be Milton Chappelle. Milton Chappelle, since 1976, has been an attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. He was also counsel of record for the petitioner, Mr. Davenport, in the companion case. This was Washington versus the Washington Education Association and Davenport versus the Washington Education Association. Those two cases were heard together. Mr. Chappelle has had more years under his belt litigating issues like this than I could count, and I'm sure he doesn't want me to count them.
Thank you.
He has also published extensively in this area and has represented clients in trying to sort of mitigate or eliminate the sort of downside of compulsory unionism and similar activities in front of numerous courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Chappelle.
Thank you, Eric. And also, in addition to helping out on the moot for the Attorney General, I also thank you for the amicus brief you wrote for Cato and some others in support of our position. And in addition, when I say our, I also mean the teacher's position. Because in addition to making the arguments that the state made, on behalf of the teachers, the non-union teachers that I represent, we made some additional arguments that we were very gratified to hear Justice Alito and the Chief Justice allude to and almost adopt our position, but really didn't get answered or presented because the state was and the Solicitor General were making their position. And I'd like to talk just a little bit about what that position is. The Washington Supreme Court based its decision and finding of both strict scrutiny and the failure to meet the least restrictive test on its misapplication and misreading of the United States Supreme Court's decisions previously in a view that the United States Supreme Court has held, which we contend it has not, that non-members have to dissent or have to opt out to not pay the political part when you're in a state that has statutorily given the union the right to seize from non-members the amount of money equal to dues, as opposed to, like Attorney General mentioned, in Illinois, where the state there had only given the union the right to seize the collective bargaining or chargeable costs. And our position is that the court needs to clarify what we feel the unions have purposely misused, a phrase that the court said more than 45 years ago, first in 1961 in the Street case, and has applied it to non-members, and that they need to rule decisively that the most that the Constitution can require in the agency fee compulsory unionism statute, especially one that demands equal to dues, is that all that constitutionally can be seized is the non-chargeable portion. Now, obviously, if the court makes that ruling, the whole Washington Supreme Court case in decision goes away because it was totally based on, in it looked at it in three or four different ways, but every time it looked at the Constitution and every time it struck down the statute, it did it because it misapplied this dissent. And obviously, if the constitutional standard is that non-members have to opt in to pay anything that is not related to bargaining, including politics, obviously, Section 760, which requires that for a small subset, is also constitutional. So we actually presented, I think, a broader argument and broader support for striking down the Washington Supreme Court decision. Interestingly enough, the reason that Professor didn't even mention that is that the Washington Education Association did not respond to our argument except to drop a footnote to suggest that we were off the reservation. And then they outsourced that duty to the one amicus that they had filed on, that the AFL-CIO filed on their behalf. So hopefully the court didn't read the AFL-CIO's brief, and maybe that's why Justice Alito and Chief Justice seem to be making favorable comments. There are other questions asked by other justices that they certainly got it, and I appreciate, I think both generals made reference in their response to the Davenport petitioners have raised this, and that, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, General, and that hopefully alerts the court. So we actually are kind of pushing the envelope more than the state is, but I did want to point that out because I'm not sure it really came out in the argument because we weren't making that, you know, orally there to make that argument. But the court reads all the briefs, and I don't know if you want me to respond. We can do that through questions. Obviously, I don't agree with anything you said. Okay.
I think what we'll do now is I'm going to take the moderator's privilege to start the questioning off. We'll let the panelists go back and forth a little bit with each other, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. I'll stay seated for this point. Just as a word of disclosure, as Mr. Chappelle pointed out, I did, in fact, file a brief in this case as well on behalf of a variety of groups, the Cato Institute, the Reason Foundation, a number of nonprofit organizations that are sort of fairly libertarian. But for purposes of this panel, I am going to be the devil's advocate. So my first question will be to General McKenna and Mr. Chappelle, which is, it seems to me that this is much ado about nothing. The employee just has to say no and they get their money back. What kind of problem is that? Six of one, half dozen the other. Why suddenly single out this subcategory of speech and say it's not good enough to have the right to ask for it back? You have to affirmatively say yes. where you don't say that about a whole lot of other kinds of speech, like legislative lobbying, where they have to say no to get legislative lobby money back, but they don't have to say that vis-a-vis election campaigns. So I would ask, why the difference? Why is this limited to that?
Well, clearly this is not much ado about nothing, or else the WEA and the state would not have litigated it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. There is a good deal at stake here, and it's not just in terms of the amount of money involved, but it's also in terms of the principle. The principle is, as I mentioned earlier, that individuals who have chosen not to become members of the union shouldn't have to say no twice. They chose not to join. And the reason that this section, Section 760, only addresses influencing an election, only addresses operating a political committee, and doesn't address lobbying, is that this law that it's part of was about campaign finance. The law, the overall context was about campaign finance. And that's why when I opened my argument today, I talked about the purpose of the overall statute, which is, as the Supreme Court of our state found, to protect the integrity of our election system. But the fact they've made a finding of that purpose does not undercut the means by which, the individual protections by which they hope to achieve that purpose. Section 760 clearly provides that kind of protection because it requires the affirmative authorization. It is by no means the only part of the law that does that. There are other sections that I quoted during the argument that also are aimed at protecting individual interests. So the voters of the state of Washington made a policy decision that they wanted to provide this additional level of protection, first apparently because it would help the integrity of the election system. We don't want to we want to minimize the influence of individuals. We want to actually restore the balance of individuals in large organizations. But secondly, they clearly seem to, to the extent voters thought about this, seem to understand that you should have to say yes before they can use your money for politics if you've already said no once. I think that's what was really at issue here.
But it's okay to have to say no twice when they use your money for legislative lobbying. That's okay, according to Washington State.
Well, it's okay because the law at issue here was part of a campaign finance law. I mean, that's only as far as this law went. This is what happened to be in front of the voters. This is not to say the voters would not approve a subsequent proposal, another initiative, for example, that might extend the affirmative authorization requirement more broadly. But within this context, and this is why I focused on the purpose of the statute point so as much as I did, we think the purpose of the statute finding by the Washington State Supreme Court helps us explain why 760 zeroes in on political expenditures of this type.
Let me give Professor Freilacher a chance to respond to that if he wants, and then I'll turn to you, Milton.
I'm not sure I understand your argument, Mr. McKenna, about why the Washington Supreme Court's statement of the legislative purpose benefits you. If the legislative purpose is to sort of right the balance in terms of campaign contributions and limit them somehow, how does this particular provision serve that legislative purpose?
Well, I think Justice Souter actually got to that point very well during the rebuttal portion of today's argument when he said that protecting the individual is the other side of the coin of protecting election integrity. That's why we have to confront the fact the Supreme Court of our state did make that finding, and we think if the court believes that they shouldn't have to follow it, they don't. But we also think that individual interests clearly are at stake here, and that the plain language of the statute of 760 indicates that.
Milton?
Yeah, let me try to answer a couple of things that have been brought up, starting with the last one. The Washington Supreme Court said that the purpose was to protect the integrity of the election process and also from the perception that the election is improperly influenced by monetary contributions and the perceptions that individuals have an insignificant role to play. Now, there's two prongs there, corruption or integrity. The United States Supreme Court and other federal courts have said in upholding the Federal Election Campaign Act, the federal system, that promoting voluntary contributions in the political electoral process, which is probably as close to the heart of the First Amendment as you can get, prevents corruption. It is also an anti-corruption requirement. This, the Washington Supreme Court also said that they were trying to balance and give a significant role for individuals. You give that significant role by making sure that this is what the individual wants. This is why you have to have an affirmative opt-in provision to make sure. The courts have also ruled, including the federal court here in D.C., that the opt-out provision does not guarantee that the contributions are voluntarily and knowingly made. U.S. Supreme Court and Pipefitters also said that that was a requirement under the Corruption and the Federal Election Campaign Act statutes. So it can only be achieved, and actually the opt-out system magnifies that it's a group gift, and it subjects the individual to the group, and they don't have to their own say. And finally, I think you also asked in the first part of your question, Eric, about, well, it's a big deal about nothing here, isn't it, between opt-in and opt-out. No, it's not a big, I mean, it is a big deal. Because when the WEA, for their political, they chose on their own for their PAC money to go from an opt-out system to an opt-in system, the actual contributions reversed. They went from 80% when you had to go take a step to stop it to 20% when you had to take a step to contribute the money. And I thought that, and it resonated with me because I've done the same thing, but when we were doing one of the moot courts with Solicitor General Clement, he, in answering one of the questions from the moot justices, obviously a question not asked today, he said, I always buy TurboTax, and I'm always going to send in that rebate to get my money back, and I never do. And I think the inertia issue is huge. The government's using it, and their own figures show, and we've got to protect the electoral system, that it be voluntary, and this is the only way to do it.
Unless you have something else, I was going to open it up to the audience.
I was just going to simply say that the statute itself doesn't promote voluntary contributions. It requires that non-members pay the dues. And then the question is, how are the dues going to be used once it's paid? And that raises questions about whether you're limiting the union's use of those dues and in terms of the political content of what the union's interested in. So this is not a voluntary contribution statute to begin with. That's all I want to say about it.
It is.
We can get back to that. I'll make sure we get back to it. In fact, I'll take the last question. But in the interim, if the audience has some questions, do we have a mic or anything? All the way in the back. So I'll play traffic cop.
I could throw a softball to Milton, but I'll ask Professor Freelicher. Jim Young, National Right to Work Foundation. Professor Freelicher, could you explain how the existing statutory scheme of forced speech, which is, of course, subject to scrutiny, how a requirement of dissent serves the requirements of strict scrutiny, requiring an expression of dissent rather than assuming that someone who has never manifested any indicia of consent actually consents?
I would say that, speaking for the Washington Education Association, of course, that they would say that you start with the proposition of strict scrutiny. If you accept that proposition, then you're looking for the way of limiting, of giving people the right to say no about the use of their dues for political purposes that is the least impinging on the right of the union to use that money for political purposes. And the way that works in the federal system so far in the private sector is that you have to opt out. That's the least intrusive way of preserving the non-union members' rights. This is more intrusive because it creates a situation where, as Mr. Chappelle pointed out, the people are not going to exercise that right as easily, and there's going to be more money lost. This has to do with money.
Yep. Well, actually, let General McKenna follow up, I think, and we'll get some more questions.
Professor Freelicher has accurately characterized or described the WEA's argument that the union has a right to use this money once they've collected it, and that indeed was the state Supreme Court's position as well. But where it fails is that, in fact, they don't have a right to the money, at least not in a constitutional sense. They're given a statutory right to collect it and a statutory right to use it, but it's conditioned by this affirmative authorization requirement. Once they've met that condition, then, yes, they can use it for whatever they wish within the free speech realm. The statute doesn't prevent them from spending on any kind of political speech they want once they've obtained the affirmative authorization. Now, let me just give you a point of comparison to help illustrate this idea. The union would agree, in following the opt-out procedure that they wish to follow, that during the 30-day period, this little 30-day window they give teachers to go through an inch-thick stack of paper and then remember to write their own letter, because it doesn't give them any kind of form they can check off, to write a letter that has to meet 10 different requirements laid out, that during that process, they can't use those non-member teachers' money either during that 30-day period. They can't use it for political speech. They have to escrow it. So they agree with that, and so if there is a restriction on their use, yes, it exists. It's statutory, and it's no more onerous in the important sense than the restriction on their use under the procedure they wish to follow, which the court has upheld.
Other questions?
This is to Mr. McKenna and Mr. Chappelle. During oral argument today, was there any treatment of the line in the 1961 Supreme Court case of Machinist versus Street pertaining to dissent shall not be presumed, and does the statute operate as such dissent, or conversely, does the mere fact that someone is a non-member qualify as presumed dissent?
It's a good question. I didn't hear any questions from the justices that expressly addressed that. I didn't even hear it implied. Our position in the briefs is that dissent does not have to be presumed because they've already dissented from joining the union. And having made that decision, they've made it pretty clear they don't wish to be associated with the union, and therefore there's no violation of the dissent is not to be presumed a principle.
I think Justice Alito, in one of the questions that he asked, I believe it was the Solicitor General, seemed to suggest that shouldn't the standard be that we should just make any non-bargaining a opt-in requirement? And he didn't say Street, and he didn't use dissent as not to be presumed, but I took his questioning to be answering your question. But there was no real major discussion of it. Other than a reference to, well, the Davenport petitioners have talked about that or brought it up, or however you nicely said it.
That's a good point that Milton makes about Justice Alito, because dissent is not to be presumed was, as you point out, in the Street case, that was about all non-chargeable, non-germane expenses, not just political speech.
Yeah, why people don't join unions varies. Some employees don't join unions because they don't want to be subject to union discipline. They don't like the idea of having to subject themselves to a picket line requirements and be fined if they go through a picket line. Other people don't join unions for a variety of reasons that don't relate to the fact that the union is using some of their money for political purposes. I don't think you can assume that somebody doesn't join a union because they don't like the idea that the union is using some of their dues money for political purposes, and that's why they don't join unions, particularly if they have to pay money anyway for the equivalent of dues. They have to pay it to the union, and certainly in the private sector, they have the option to opt out.
Let me respond to that, because it wasn't something that was made at the argument, but it is in the briefs. John West, who you're playing the role of quite well, said that it was mere speculation on either side for whether the non-members also dissent or should be viewed to disagree with the union on politics. And then he kind of scoffed at that and went on, but we do class sizes and we do teachers' pay, and, of course, no one would disagree with that was the implication. He didn't quite say it. Justice Alito wasn't buying it, so, again, I like that. But the record does answer the question. It is not mere speculation, and the record in the Davenport case does have why the teachers, they were asked the question by the unions for why they did not want to join. And there are various reasons. You're right on that point. But they agree with disagreement with the union on morals and values, differences over political issues, candidates' initiatives. And I like this one. One of the teachers testified, I sometimes agree with the union on their political, but that's not the issue. I want the choice for myself to decide what to support politically. I don't want to be told, and I don't want some organization to assume what is best for me. And to me, that's the whole issue of the First Amendment, is individual choice. I love that one. And the record goes on with more of the reasons, and so hopefully the court will remember that it is not mere speculation on both sides.
Other questions from the audience? Let me start over there, and I'll get right back to you.
Thanks. I have two questions. First, does 760 codify any specific regulations for the opt-in procedures for the unions? And where do they come up with a 30-day window? Is that just something that the unions come up with?
Yeah, the union came up with a 30-day window. They invented their Hudson procedure. The statute, Section 760, does not specify what the union must do in order to comply. It provides flexibility. They could reduce the fee in advance by the amount of the 760 expenses, or they could take the full fee equal to dues and then provide a refund later. The union agreed under the permanent injunction entered by the trial court prior to the state Supreme Court to a scheme of collecting a full fee and then providing refunds.
And also, I was wondering if you could touch upon the content discrimination argument that played heavily in today's proceedings.
Well, there's a disagreement, of course, between the two sides over whether or not Section 760 amounts to content discrimination because, as we've already discussed, the opt-in requirement, the affirmative authorization requirement, is only for those expenses spent on influencing an election or operating a political committee. We believe that's essentially content neutral because it's any kind of election. It doesn't matter what the political viewpoint is which is being expressed or what the activities of the political committee are, which can be quite broad and varied. It only matters that it's political. And as political speech, in terms of the political speech rights of the non-members, it's fairly important, and it's not a bad idea from a policy point of view to provide that higher level of protection for the First Amendment interests of the non-members.
Well, I think the legislators knew what the union would be using the money for, and it wasn't something that some of them would agree with you that it was neutral. And that is, I think, part of the reason why they put these limitations on the use of the money. I did want to comment on something that you and Mr. Chappelle said earlier about the money and whose money is it, because that really is a very important issue in this case. The statute authorizes the union to collect the dues money from members and the equivalent from non-members. And I think the Washington Education Association would take the position that as soon as that money is collected, it's the Washington Education Association's money. And you're placing a limitation on how that money can be spent politically. I know you don't agree with that.
I don't think the WEA agrees with that, Professor, because that would create an Ellis violation right off the bat. Even they agree that it's not their money to use however they see fit until after they meet their self-imposed 30-day requirement for opt-out.
I'm not talking about the 30-day requirement.
You mean
itself.
After the 30 days have
yes.
been met? Well, at that point, though, in their minds, they've satisfied the requirements of law. And our point is that they haven't because the law goes farther than their opt-out procedure. But.
Right.
And the Washington Supreme Court interpreted the statute to say that a failure to respond to the Hudson notice was not affirmative authorization required under 760.
That's
binding on the United States Supreme Court. And 760 is an encumbrance. They may have possession, but they don't have freedom to use it. It's similar to wills, trust accounts. There's a ton of legal examples of a similar kind of situation where maybe somebody has possession, but it doesn't give them freedom to use it wherever and however they want.
Richard?
Richard Samp of the Washington Legal Foundation. I have a question that is related, although perhaps a little bit far afield from today's argument. It's pretty clear from today's argument and prior cases that the Supreme Court recognizes a strong right on the part of employees to opt out of political contributions. What about the right to opt out altogether from the collective bargaining process? I've always thought that it's a much greater infringement on the right of employees to be required to not be able to cut their own deal. If they're the most talented employee within the bargaining unit, what right does federal law have to tell them, no, the union's going to tell you how much you're going to make, and if they decide that you're no better than the other workers, that's up to them. Is there any basis in any of this constitutional law for challenging that sort of statutory limitation?
Richard, are you referring to right-to-work laws or something even beyond those?
I'm talking about the right under federal law of the union to be the exclusive bargaining agent for an individual who may want to opt out of that.
Well, when I become president, you're the first nominee to the Supreme Court. Because, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has decided the Constitution wrongly and has said that there's enough state interest to override the First Amendment interest. They did recognize that non-members have a First Amendment interest not to be forced to associate with the union even for collective bargaining purposes or to be forced to pay for even collective bargaining purposes. But unfortunately, they found that the supposed state interest in labor peace and eliminating the free rider was enough to, I guess, constitutionally go ahead and infringe on those First Amendment rights. But that's where they drew the line, and then anything else the union spends for, there's no state interest, so therefore the First Amendment infringement and turns into a right of the non-member not to be compelled, and we, of course, made the argument that means that it's only opt-in.
Right, so even if you had to pay the union dues, might you not have the right to say, I want to cut my own deal?
Well, the Supreme Court, I believe, has upheld the constitutionality of what we call monopoly bargaining or exclusive representation. Again, I think it's wrong, but I'm not on the court and I'm not president.
Well, this goes back a long ways, really, to the Wagner Act, the 1935 law and the 1947 law, and the concept was one of exclusivity, that if a majority of the employees select the union as their bargaining representative, the union represents everyone. It must do so fairly. There is a duty of fair representation. And when Taft-Hartley was passed and we had the section of the law, Section 14, that gave the states the right to bar forms of compulsory unionism to whatever extent they wanted to, that was an opportunity, I think, to consider some of the arguments that you're making. And there was this, we might call it a compromise, in Section 14. But the Congress, even the Republican Congress, simply did not accept what you're saying. And you see, I mean, there are countries in Europe where you don't have exclusivity. And I wonder where the union, there may be a number of unions, and the employer has to bargain with all of them, each of them representing a group of employees, it doesn't work very well. Our concept in this country, which is a democratic concept, I think is the better one.
Do we have other questioners? Let's try in the back over there.
I'm Bruce Cameron, and my question is for Attorney General McKenna. What if the voters of the state of Washington voted to eliminate exclusive representation? To follow up on the other question, do you think that would simplify this whole area so there'd be no coercion whatsoever and no question that the unions never owned those employees' funds?
So, again, it sounds like you're also describing something that might be a right-to-work law. Is that
no,
what you mean? Exclusive representation, no monopoly bargaining.
That's right. If they had, for example, a referendum which said that a union will never represent anyone who doesn't want to be represented by that
right.
union. If they
right. yes,
approved that, a referendum like that, do you think that would simplify this whole area?
Well, assuming for the sake of your question that would be upheld, you know, itself as constitutional, would it simplify things? Yes, because the rationale for compelling agency fees is that the union occupies that monopoly bargaining position, that the teacher then works under the contract negotiated for her or for him. And if you took away that rationale because the union was no longer the collective bargaining representative or the exclusive representative for that non-member teacher, that would seem to take away the rationale for charging them even for the collective bargaining expenses.
Do you see any constitutional problem with that?
Well, that's not an area I've studied, so I can't really answer that. Milton kind of got at that a little bit, and Professor Freelicker might be able to. I just can't answer that.
I'll actually take the privilege of the next question because I think that segues nicely into it, which Rob's heard before. And this is really to both Professor Freelicker and General McKenna. It seems that if we're acknowledging that there is a First Amendment interest on the part of employees to not contribute, absent some compelling reason to make them contribute to the union,
yeah,
and we're accepting the notion that a percentage of the dues amount is non-germane to that compelling interest, how is it that the baseline law that authorizes a full dues deduction is constitutional to begin with? Forget the 706. Why is it that you're allowed to take the excess fees at all?
Mm-hmm.
And that's my question to both the putative union side, which obviously that might mean they do okay in this case but sort of lose the war, and as well to the state, which means maybe they win the battle but lose the underlying statute.
And Justice Jaffe, I'm
channeling Justice Alito at the moment.
Justice Jaffe was on my moot court panel, as I mentioned earlier. So I take your question to mean that, or let me say it back to you, make sure I understand it, that why should the union be able to take it? You mean why should they be able to collect a full dues amount for fee at all?
Given that we accept that a portion of that amount is non-germane.
Right, but you don't mean collect it and then keep it even if it's non-germane. You mean why should they collect it in the first instance?
Yeah, well, implicitly not keep it,
right.
Yes, but not even take it at the front end.
And the answer is that I would give in defending our statute is that is the answer that the Supreme Court gave, which it is enough of a protection for the non-member if they can obtain a refund later, if they can opt out and obtain a refund later. Of course, in our state, we have the opt-in for certain kinds of expenditures, but the Supreme Court has held that there is enough protection, that non-member is not being compelled to spend on non-germane expenses because they can get the money back after they've paid it.
Well, but the narrowly tailored, a sufficient protection kind of argument would work okay if there were some state interest justifying at the front end. But if there's no state interest justifying the excess exaction, it doesn't matter how easy or how hard it is if the state has no basis to take to even go down that path. It's sort of a preemptive problem under First Amendment analysis.
In other words, if there's no compelling interest that justifies them keeping the money permanently.
Taking the money.
Well, no, but also,
ever.
Or keeping it.
Well,
in other
either
words,
one.
Right? In
but
other words, you have to give it back. There's no compelling interest that justifies them keeping the non-germane interest.
I'm saying, what's
right.
The interest in taking it? Forget keeping it for a minute. Why do they get to take it at all?
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is that the court is not terribly clear about that, except to say that they seem to be balancing this compelling interest in keeping some of the money for collective bargaining and empowering the unions in that way with their interest in protecting the First Amendment interests of the union, which they construe more broad, of the non-members of the union, which they construe more broadly than just political expenses, but to include all non-germane. So they basically said, well, it's good enough if you have opt-out. We're going to put Hudson procedures in place you have to follow. You can't have an involuntary loan. And they've, for some reason, decided that's close enough, and they never really explain why. Instead, they uphold legislative determinations that that's adequate. And as a matter of statutory interpretation, they seem to think that both the mandatory agency fees and allowing them to take more than they can actually keep is okay.
And Professor Freelicker, before you answer from the union perspective, let me add that in Hudson itself, the statute at issue actually didn't let them collect non-germane fees. It forced them to do a front-end deduction of things that were obviously non-germane, and the only sort of opt-out procedure went to disputed items that may or may not have been germane. So from a union perspective, why is it that the union gets to basically get state assistance in collecting money that it has no entitlement to?
I think the question is whether it has no entitlement to it.
To the non-germane fees. We're only talking non-germane fees
well,
now.
Well, I think you have to start with, let's talk about the germane fees to begin with.
Yes.
And the germane aspect of the fees. I think it's national labor policy that people who get the services of a union for collective bargaining and related matters should have to pay for it. Okay? And that includes both union members and non-members. To compromise on that issue, the Supreme Court said that non-members do not have to pay their dues for non-germane matters. They don't have to pay, for example, for political contributions. And that's the way that issue was satisfied. Now, I'm not sure I understand beyond that what you're talking about.
Well, if we both agree that they shouldn't have to pay, they should have to pay for germane things, collective bargaining, grievance adjustment, but they should not have to pay for political speech and Christmas parties that they're not invited to.
Right.
If we agree on those two propositions, then the question is, why does the union get to make an initial exaction of the money for a Christmas party that the person could ask for back? Why do you have to ask for it back in the first place? Why doesn't the union just take their fee for service, not take the portion of the fee that doesn't go to service?
As a practical matter, you don't know what the person who's paying the dues feels about this. It may feel that it's perfectly okay to use it for the Christmas party, or it may not be okay. So you collect the dues. I mean, it's just a practical way of handling it, it seems to me. You collect the dues, and if the person doesn't like what the dues are being used for, that are not germane to the collective bargaining, it says so. He says so.
But isn't it practical to assume that a non-member doesn't want you to take any more than they have to, and since he can't go to the Christmas party, since we're using that example, he would in no way want to pay for somebody else having fun at the Christmas party that he can't or she can't even attend. And let me correct two other things you said. The Supreme Court actually has held that union members, that was the street court case, could ask for the money back. It's not limited to non-members. And we all believe that the Supreme Court has ever held that non-members have to ask for it back, that scheme is correct. And, of course, we're asking for clarification. And one can argue in Hudson that the Supreme Court, because it was viewing and was setting forth the constitutional standard, and it was viewing it in the terms of a statute that did not allow the union to take this money, as Eric has talked about, has already held that that is the only constitutional way to apply or to enforce a statute like Washington has.
I think we have time for one more question from the audience, if there is one. Right in the back of the middle.
This is to anyone on the panel. To what extent did the record reflect the burden to the union, whether it be administrative or monetary, in the opt-in provision?
Well, the union, of course, did argue that there was a significant burden on them resulting from the affirmative authorization requirement, and the state Supreme Court found that it would be a costly burden full of complexity. And we realize that the state Supreme Court was referring to just a certain section of the testimony from the trial record in reaching that conclusion, where one of the WEA staffers said, well, we'll have to send out two bills, it'll be very complex, and woe is us. But in fact, we note that they already choose to do that for PAC contributions because they've chosen to establish a PAC, and under state law they cannot obtain mandatory payroll deductions through dues, cannot obtain dues through mandatory payroll deductions. So they volunteered for that, and they managed to come up with a system which apparently works for them under the permanent injunction, where they agreed to provide refunds. So they still collect the whole fee, but they've got a refund system set up. And what they did, quite simply, is they created another billing code. So they built within the WEA, they build their time out. They used to have just one very, very broad category for all non-chargeable expenses, essentially, all non-chargeable expenses, and they simply added another billing code so that a WEA person who's spending time on influencing an election now writes down code 93. So they have code 91 and code 93 instead of just a single code 98. They've managed to come up with a way to comply. And consequently, we don't think that there really is certainly no constitutionally problematic burden on them administratively.
There's one interesting point in the record, and you'll have to tell me why you did this. because I don't understand it. But the union said that they had no intention of complying with the statute. They wanted the court to devise a system that basically said, we're not going to ask for this money. Now, how do we comply with the statute? Because we're not going to follow the procedures the statute lay out. It blows my mind. And then they bill from that, oh, it's so unfair. But actually, there's nothing about how easy it is for them to ask. And, of course, you mentioned it, I think, in the oral argument. We mentioned it throughout. And one of the expert witnesses at the trial also mentioned they can just add something to the Hudson notice that they're already, because of the constitutional requirements, required to send every non-member anyway.
Well, they didn't want to comply with the statute, probably because their lawyers told them it was unconstitutional. And this is the way you challenge it.
That's all for the questions. I think I'm going to give each panelist a chance to, you know, make any wrap up for a minute or so. And Professor Villacroix, I'm going to give you the last word. So I figure, given that you've been bracketed by putative opponents and you've been forced into this role, you'll get the last word. But so why don't we start with Milton, then General McKenna, and then Professor Frolick.
Well, I was cautiously optimistic. I'm obviously pleased with the way the argument went and the questioning of the justices, including some of the specific justices I was caring a lot about. I also well know that you can't totally count your whatever it is before they hatch. But I'm hopeful that we will win. And as I said before, from our point of view and from the non-members' point of view, because it provides them even greater relief from this compulsion, that the Justice Alito and the Chief Justice and some of the others will take our offer and clarify the rule and make it clear that the unions can't abuse the Hudson process.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the Federalist Society for putting this event together and the National Press Club for allowing us to hold it here. Secondly, thanks to my co-panelists, especially Professor Feilacher. I'll be on your campus recruiting before long, so perhaps I can come by and look you up. I'll be out at the end of the month, actually. And third, I want to thank the National Right to Work Foundation, which I haven't properly and publicly done. They were, because of the consolidated cases, our partners, and they've just been phenomenal to work with, very, very collaborative, very, very good to work with. And I think I would probably speak for Milton as well in saying the U.S. Solicitor General and his office was also really terrific to work with and really greatly assisted our preparation for this case. Milton also, by the way, did a terrific job as my co-counsel, helping me spot things in the record, the few things we didn't already have written down. He was just an ideal co-counsel there. Thank you so much, Milton, for that.
And I should say thanks to both generals for their cooperation.
It worked out well. And I just want to say that, in conclusion, there are important First Amendment interests at stake here for the teachers. That's why the law, why we're working so hard to overturn the Supreme Court and uphold this law. We certainly hope that Mr. Chappelle's prediction is accurate and that these First Amendment interests are validated or vindicated by the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think it's probable that the Supreme Court will reverse. I think it took certiorari in this case. Because it was troubled by the Washington Supreme Court's decision. I'm not advocating for the WEA now. I'm just sort of giving you a little bit of a summary of where things stand now. And I after hearing the argument this morning, I think it's likely that the Washington Supreme Court will be reversed. But I think we'll be on relatively narrow grounds that the court decides the case. I know that some of the people from the Right to Work Foundation would like some broad-based policy kinds of statements from the court, but they're probably not going to get it. I think the court was troubled by the Washington Supreme Court's discussion of this being a kind of a content-based political speech. I think even some of the more liberal justices were troubled by that. But it's an interesting case, and I'm happy to have the benefit of the views of the panelists and Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all of our panelists, particularly General McKenna and Mr. Chappelle, for coming here after what undoubtedly was a a high-stress morning, and they'd probably rather be decompressing somewhere right now. I'd like to thank Professor Freilacher for ably standing in on a side which he may or may not agree with. We'll never know, as a good professor is capable on both sides, but you did an excellent job of the position. I'd like to thank the staff at the National Federal Society for putting this all together, the Press Club for having us, and all of you for coming. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.